This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's up, Katie?
Just enjoying this stormy day, which I believe you have the most of now because our wind and rain is gone.
Yes.
But it was a lovely walk through the rain this morning with a few clients.
I love the bracing breezes, you know.
I love the alliteration of that. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I have my voice almost completely back, as y'all can probably tell.
It's good to hear.
Yeah.
It's good to hear it.
So glad I'm not, like, sick anymore.
Yeah. Not fun being sick.
No. It was a draining past 2 weeks, but I'm excited to be back. I'm in the director's chair today.
You guys are going to hear the lovely soundscapes of both my cats and Goose today. So that's enjoyable. That's enjoyable.
I always do what I can in editing.
But before we can jump into this episode, we have some patrons to announce.
Yes, we do. We realized we forgot the last couple episodes. Things have been crazy. So we have a good list. First... we have Bailey B, our newest dream maker. Hi, Bailey.
What's up, Bailey?
Bailey spells her name with a double E at the end. And forever, forever, that is how it is spelled. I will accept no other spellings of Bailey.
Absolutely. That should be the only name with two E's next to each other at the end like that. And the only spelling of Bailey. I completely agree. Following Bailey, we have Mariana M, a helpful little bug.
Thanks for being here, Mariana.
Yes, thank you so much.
After that, we have Michaela A. Hey, Michaela, another helpful little bug. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I really love your username in Patreon. I'll just say that. The next helpful little bug we have is Cheyenne S. I fucking love the name Cheyenne.
Yeah, it's a pretty great name.
I need you to catch up on The Last of Us because there's like a little comment on the name Cheyenne. Just like a little back and forth.
Oh,
and it was really adorable.
I'm behind. Oh,
I know.
Thanks for being here, Cheyenne. And last we have... Stevie S.
With the coolest name ever.
I love your name. It's giving me Schitt's Creek vibes and I love it.
Oh, yeah. It's giving me Stevie Nicks vibes.
Oh, yes. Even better. Thanks for being here, everyone. We are so excited to have you.
We just recently sent out our first round of Patreon mail. So if you've been a patron... I think like up until the 2nd or 3rd of February was the cutoff for getting a little something special in the mail to show our appreciation. And if you guys get those, please take pictures and tag us because that I want to know that you got them just so we can hold the mail people accountable.
Yes, we want to know that you have
them. Not feeding my ego or anything.
Somebody did message us that they got there, so yay. We know one made it to its destination. We accomplished something.
Yes.
Anyways, if we have nothing else, why don't we get into it?
That's all I've got.
This week, we're featuring a topic chosen by our dream maker patron, Katie Bjorkman.
Yes!
I know, I'm so excited. This is our first patron-picked episode also.
I'm so pumped.
Katie is from Washington State and gave us a couple ideas, one of which is the story of serial killer Jake Bird, who was captured in Washington. We don't usually focus on true crime stories, not really our thing.
Yes.
Although, that's not to say that we don't love listening to true crime ourselves.
And I am interested in the brains of dangerous people. I find it fascinating. I have no other way that I can put that, really.
Yeah. All right. We don't want to disappoint anyone, so we're going to come at this from a different angle. We want to tell a brief overview of Jake Bird's story, but what we really want to focus on in this episode is inadequate legal representation, most notably in cases where the death penalty is on the docket.
I feel like... whether you agree with the death penalty or not, no one would be against the idea that everyone who's like in a death penalty
trial should have the best representation that they can possibly have.
You would hope.
You would hope.
I want to start this by saying that Jake Bird 100% is guilty of this crime. That much will become evident. But what I found after some digging was the horrific manner in which the trial was performed. In a just society, our goal should always be to give a fair trial, especially when discussing the matter of condemning someone to death. No matter who it is, no matter what the charges are, if we fail for one, we fail for all.
Absolutely.
Back in 1947, Jake Bird, who was 45 at the time, was living a transient lifestyle, working on and using the railroad system to move from town to town. He had a long criminal history of burglaries, assaults, attempted murder, and murder. Before this, he had served around 15 years in prison for various crimes. On October 30th, he broke into the home of Bertha Klutt and her daughter, Beverly June. After removing his shoes, he enters Bertha's first floor bedroom, and when he turns back out to the kitchen, he is faced with her and attempts to sexually assault her before bludgeoning her with an axe that he found at a nearby shed. And that's when Beverly came running down the stairs, and Jake then bludgeons her in the kitchen.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah. Thanks, I hate it.
I hate it so much.
During all of this, a neighbor had called the police and reported hearing screams coming from the residence. Tacoma police officers Andrew P. Sabutis and Evan Skip Davies arrived on the scene to find Bird escaping barefoot through the back door and crashing through a picket fence, to which they immediately pursued him. After scaling several fences, Jake was stopped by a fence that was too high to climb and was cornered by the officers. He pulled a knife on them and then attacked, cutting Davies' hand and stabbing Sabutis in the shoulder.
Shit.
He was eventually subdued by Sabutis with, and I thought it was interesting that this was how they detailed it, but with a left hook to the jaw and a kick to the groin.
Oh.
They did take him to the hospital after this, where he was attended to for head and face lacerations.
Huh. Okay. Not something you see now. Medical care after police violence. Anyway,
Bird was then interrogated at the Tacoma City Jail, where he dictated and signed a confession in the presence of four officers. He stated that he had entered the home to commit an easy burglary, and that he had the axe to, quote, bluff off anyone who tried to bother me. He also stole $1.50 from Bertha's purse before she confronted him. His account of the night was that he told her that he just wanted the money and would leave, but then Beverly grabbed him from behind and they all struggled, and that's when he killed them both. He also stated that he believed the officers would shoot him when he was cornered, and that is why he attacked them with his knife.
Valid concern to be worried about getting shot while you are murdering someone.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're in the process of murdering someone. So, I don't really know if being like, well, they were gonna shoot me, so I went after them first. Like, bro.
They just caught you committing murder.
Yeah. It's justifiable.
Yeah.
Be like, hey, stop killing people.
He was charged with first degree murder, but only in her death, which was customary at the time in order to charge them with a second offense in the chance that the first trial ended with a not guilty verdict. So they were like holding on to Beverly's just in case.
You had me in the first half, not gonna lie. I was ready to be really mad, but that makes perfect legal sense.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The judge, Edward D. Hodge, appointed James W. Selden as Jake's defense counsel. And Selden was a former Pierce County prosecutor.
Ooh. And is that the county that they're in?
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
At the motion hearing that November, Selden requested a change of venue on the grounds of an unfair trial in Pierce County.
Okay.
Yeah, right?
Okay. So this is the wild ride. I'm like waiting. I'm like, is he the shitty representation?
He also asked to be relieved as Bird's attorney at the request of Bird, but the judge denied both requests.
What?
Weird, right?
That is super weird.
The jury selection questioning revolved around asking jurors what their impressions of the defendant were due to media coverage and whether they believed that a black man could receive a fair trial. Four jurors were excused after it was revealed they had just served in another trial for first-degree murder where the defendant was found guilty and hanged.
Huh. I've never served jury duty before.
Me either.
So I don't know anything about the process other than like what I'm told through television.
Yeah.
But maybe I need to look into that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. The episode where Tina Fey served on jury duty in 30 Rock, I'm sure, is filled with only accurate information.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm gonna need to look into that because I'm under the impression, I don't want to say I know, I'm under the impression that each attorney can, like, veto, like, a potential jury member.
Yeah.
Is there, like, a limit on the amount of times they can do that?
You know, I'm not sure. There might be. We can look into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we do a jury duty episode.
Ooh, yeah.
Try and make jury duty sound fun. Okay. That's just really interesting. I see why they would want to get rid of someone.
Yes.
Who like just was like solid on death penalty.
There's definitely a bias there.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Mm. The trial testimony was extremely speedy, lasting only 1.5 days. When do you ever see that? That's crazy.
1.5 days.
1.5 days of testimony.
I've had poops that lasted longer.
Oh my God. The entire trial itself only lasting 5 days.
Oh my God.
Crazy, right?
Okay. Not that the devil needs any advocates.
It is 1947.
It's 1947 and we're talking about a black man.
Yeah.
We're also talking about, they kind of walked up on him. They kind of caught him.
Red-handed.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of me at first, I was like, well, that is so short. But at the same time, like, that's also pretty long considering it's interesting that he pled not guilty. That's, like, the only way you would go to trial, mm-hmm. right? It's interesting that, like, it lasted that long when the police are like, well, I don't know. This is really complicated and layered.
Especially because still everyone deserves to have a fair trial. So no matter who you are, what you did. The prosecutor, attorney Patrick M. Steele, needed to prove that the murder was premeditated to be able to qualify Bird for the death penalty.
Okay, that makes more sense. Okay.
Physical evidence of the case was blood and brain tissue from both women being on Bird's clothes, his bloody fingerprints on the axe and in the house, and his shoes found at the scene. So, when I told you he did it, we know he did. How the trial was handled was bullshit.
It's... Hold on. I'm trying to form my words.
Okay.
Can you say that sentence again?
Physical evidence of the case was blood and brain tissue from both women being on his clothes, his bloody fingerprints on the axe and in the house, and his shoes found at the scene.
Maybe you don't know this, and maybe this is another good thing to look up. Would he have gotten the death penalty automatically if he pled guilty?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
Because if so, I understand why they wanted to fight it. But this is just, it's from what I know about like all of this stuff, it's just really, it's so interesting that this went to trial.
Mm-hmm. Because of the sheer fact of being like caught in the act.
Well, because of being caught in the act and like, I wonder.
It's like, do you need to have a trial to be able to charge someone with the death penalty? Is that the question?
Maybe they just didn't even, for many reasons, including racism, just didn't even want to accept a non-guilty plea and were like, no, I'm going to trial and I'm going for the death penalty. Do you have the right to plead not guilty? The 40s were a weird time. I have a lot to look into. This is so interesting. Okay.
The state also introduced a surprise witness, Tacoma Police Officer John Hickey. I'm going to read a quote from HistoryLink.org about his testimony. Quote, Hickey testified that he and Officer Russell Scadam gave Byrd a beating while he was in their custody. Hickey said, quote, "I regret to say that I lost my temper after returning from the Klutt home and viewing the terribly hacked bodies of the two women. I had asked Byrd as we sat in the patrol wagon why he murdered the two women. He said he didn't do it. I asked him who did it then, and he said it was Leroy. Who's Leroy? I asked him. Oh, another N-word around town, Byrd replied. You're lying, I replied. And he looked at me with a smug and insolent look. I know I shouldn't have done it, but I hit him in the jaw with my fist, knocking him to the front of the patrol wagon. Then I struck him a number of times with my nightstick until he said, don't kill me. That brought me to my senses, and we took him to the hospital, where a nurse said he wasn't badly hurt." End quote. And if you're thinking back to when I first said the police took him to the hospital, I hope I wasn't the only one who thought, that seems like a lot of injuries for just being subdued by the first set of officers, and our thinking would have been correct. This is another example of police brutality, and no matter the situation, the police should never be acting as judge, jury, and executioner.
Absolutely. I knew something felt weird about that situation. Mm-hmm. We talk about this instance all the time, and it's the idea of putting cops in a situation, whether it's hypothetical like SVU or hypothetical like in conversation or a story in SVU or a situation like this, where we're like, yeah, it's okay that the cops beat this guy because he's bad. He was caught hacking up women. And I understand the notion of wanting to allow those moments to slide, but every instance and every loophole, every inch that we give to people to break rules, those instances are always going to be used disproportionately against innocent members of minority communities. Allowing that to happen to anyone, horrible person or not, just makes room for more incidents like that to happen and more areas where we're like, it's okay though, because it's not. No matter who it is, it's not okay.
100%. I agree with literally everything you just said.
Like, you can't just go Elliot Stabler on people. That's not okay.
No, you can't. It is not okay. When the prosecutor moved to enter the signed confession into evidence, defense attorney Selden objected on the grounds of the confession being made under duress and therefore inadmissible, but Judge Hodge disagreed, ruling that there was no relationship between the beating and Byrd's voluntary confessions. Thus, it was admitted into evidence. Dude. Here's my question. Those two officers that beat him, were they two of the four in the room?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Because if they were, under duress.
Absolutely under duress.
You could absolutely argue that in court.
The other question that I wanted to ask earlier was, you said that he dictated a confession and then signed it. So making some assumptions here, that leads me to believe that like he couldn't necessarily write his own confession. Was he able to read what he signed surrounded by four police officers?
Did they write what he actually said?
Well, that's what kind of what I'm getting at is like, is he sure that what he signed is what he actually confessed to? How is this not under duress?
Obviously, with all of the witness testimony and the physical evidence pointing to him being the guilty party. But even with all of that, when police take matters of court into their own hands by beating the person in custody, we already see a failure of any kind of justice system. The cards are already stacked against someone in the eyes of the law when we have officials taking brutal actions when the phrase is innocent until proven guilty. How are we supposed to then have a fair trial? Do you have something to say?
Yeah, just because I'm an asshole and autistic. Is it innocent until proven guilty when you came up and caught him red-handed?
I think that is one of those, like when we talked about with Lauren, one of those moral versus ethical questions. The ethics of the justice system, or what they're supposed to be, is innocent until proven guilty. The moral thing is, damn, we saw this dude leaving the residence where he just murdered these women and all of this evidence was on him. That's different from having to go through a system where everyone's supposed to be treated the same. Supposed to.
Yeah. You're totally right. Goddamn. Couldn't be me, man. I could not have that job.
On November 26th, the jury went to deliberate at noon, and they were out only 35 minutes before returning. I know. Sometimes I wish people could see us when we roll our eyes. They were out only 35 minutes before returning a guilty verdict for the charge of first-degree murder, and the jury voted to impose the death penalty. To be honest, dude, with my research, I don't think it was necessarily proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the act of murder was premeditated.
No.
Like, I fully know that this man is guilty of the actual murder, but if the parameters for the death penalty are having the murder be absolutely premeditated, I fail to see the proof. Did he have the axe? Yes, he did. He was walking around at night and he said he grabbed it in case anybody came up on him. Did he steal the money? Yeah, he did. $1.50. But do we know that he went in there to murder? He could have just gone in there to steal, got spooked. She ran up on him, fight ensued. He hacked him to death. As much as I, you know, hate what happened, it was disgusting, but we can't necessarily say that it was premeditated, and I think sentencing him to death was the wrong call.
Agreed. I don't believe that they proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he... No, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Do we need to start making juries justify why they believe it was beyond a reasonable doubt? How many times have we seen someone sentenced to death for a crime they didn't commit? Too many for it to not be a problem we need to fix.
Way too many, as we recall from our death penalty episode.
Mm-hmm. Before I move on to talking more about inadequate representation, we do need to discuss what happened at the sentencing hearing.
Ooh.
On December 6th, 1947, Judge Hodge sentenced Jake to be hung on the gallows at the Washington State Penitentiary. On January 16th, 1948. A motion for a new trial was denied by the judge, and Selden told the court he had done everything in his power to defend Jake and that he would make no further appeals on Jake's behalf. Judge Hodge asked for a comment from Byrd, to which he responded, "I was given no chance to defend myself. My own lawyers just asked you to hang me. They apologized for defending me. If they were so reluctant to defend me, why did they contest the prosecutor's proof of murder and now say everything is proven?" At the end of a 20-minute-long passionate speech, Byrd said, quote, "All you guys who had anything to do with this case are going to die before I do," end quote. And within a year, 5 men connected to the trial did die.
Oh, shit.
So this is where we get the Jake Byrd hex. That's what it is called, and that's why there is some notoriety to the case. The 5 men who died were Edward D. Hodge, the judge, age 69, and he died January 1st, 1948. And then we have Joseph E. Karpash, Pierce County Undersheriff, age 46, died April 5th, 1948. George L. Harrigan, Pierce County Court Reporter, age 69, June 11th, 1948. Sherman W. Lyons, Tacoma Police Detective Lieutenant, age 46, died October 28th, 1948. And James W. Selden.
Oh, damn.
Byrd's defense attorney. Age 76, died November 26th, 1948. And according to the Tacoma News Tribune, all of the men died from heart attacks.
Whoa.
All of them.
All of them.
Wild.
Wow.
And a 6th man, Arthur A. Stewart, a Washington State Penitentiary guard assigned to death row, died of pneumonia 2 months before Byrd's execution. Could just be a coincidence, but...
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. The hex is the reason for the morbid curiosity about the actions of this man, But what I took from the story was one of a horrific justice system that is all too willing to condemn its citizens to death and a lack of caring from the professionals in control of this system. There is definitely more to the earlier life of Jake Bird and all the crazy shit he was getting himself into. But as I said up front, we're not really a true crime podcast, so please feel free to do more reading and listening to other podcasts about his story, because now I will be moving on.
Can I say, I don't know if either of these podcasts have covered Jake Bird, but if you're looking for some ethical consumption of true crime, might I recommend Sinisterhood or And That's Why We Drink? Wine and Crime is pretty solid as well. It's a little bit more casual than some people like when they're ingesting their true crime, because it is a comedy show and some people have some issues with that. But Sinisterhood, they're phenomenal.
Yes.
And I would always recommend their podcast.
Thank you, Katie. Quote, I have yet to see a death case among the dozens coming to the Supreme Court on eve of execution stay applications in which the defendant was well represented at trial. People who are well represented at trial do not get the death penalty. End quote. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, April 9th, 2001.
Hell yeah. We love her.
And how right she was. Too many times has there been evidence to show that a defendant is not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Too many times have innocent people been sentenced to death when there's conflicting evidence. Too many times has the justice system failed to be fair and balanced. There are several reasons as to why we see so many examples of inadequate legal representation in capital cases: lack of funding, lack of ethical standards, and racial biases, to name a few. We'll start with the lack of funding. Capital cases are amongst the most costly to try in court. The ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, states that capital cases cost as much as 70% more than life imprisonment. 70%!
Damn.
It's absurd. A former California judge, Judge Donald McCartan, is quoted as saying, "It costs 10 times more to kill these guys than to keep them alive in prison. It's absurd." Yes, sir. I agree with you. It is absurd.
Agree.
That's according insane. To a study titled Update on Cost, Quality, and Availability of Defense Representation in Federal Death Penalty Cases, done by the Office of Defender Services of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts. Quote, the average cost of defending a trial in a federal death case is $620,932, about eight times that of a federal murder case in which the death penalty is not sought. A study found that those defendants whose representation was the least expensive, and thus who received the least amount of attorney and expert time, had an increased probability of receiving a death sentence. Defendants with less than $320,000 in terms of representation costs, the bottom third of federal capital trials, had a 44% chance of receiving a death sentence at trial. On the other hand, those defendants whose representation costs were higher than $320,000, the remaining two-thirds of the federal capital trials, had only a 19% chance of being sentenced to death. Thus, the study concluded that defendants with low representation costs were more than twice as likely to receive a death sentence. And that's a whole entire issue in itself, because once again, we are seeing how vastly a trial can differ based upon circumstances out of the defendant's control when the playing field needs to be completely even. Whew. Now I want to give you the average costs of death penalty cases, state by state. Just a few, though. If we did them all, it would take forever.
I was going to say, all 50.
I want us to have an idea of how much we're willing to pay to kill people.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you're doing this. This is, wow, yeah. Dude, this is crazy.
For California, from the report of the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice, quote, "The additional cost of confining an inmate to death row as compared to the maximum security prisons where those sentenced to life without possibility of parole ordinarily serve their sentences is $90,000 per year per inmate." Per inmate. With California's current death row population of 670, that accounts for $63.3 million annually. I really wish people could see you right now.
So you're telling me that if we stopped killing people legally for the death penalty, we could probably send everyone to college
at least in California. That's $63.3 million annually that we could use for other things.
Holy shit. Okay. Oh my God.
Using conservative rough projections, the commission estimates that the annual costs of the present death penalty system to be $137 million per year. The cost of the present system with reforms recommended by the commission to ensure a fair process would be $232.7 million a year. So to do it right and make it fair to condemn people to death, it would cost even more. The cost of a system in which the number of death-eligible crimes was significantly narrowed would be $130 million per year. Lower, okay. The cost of a system which imposes a maximum penalty of lifetime incarceration instead of the death penalty would be $11.5 million per year.
Shut the fuck up.
Heck of a lot less than $137 million, and we wouldn't be killing people.
It costs more a year to house just California's death penalty people than it would if we stopped killing people in the holy shit, Ashley.
It's crazy, right? Okay, be ready to have your mind blown more. A study released by the Urban Institute on March 6, 2008, forecasted that the lifetime expenses of capitally prosecuted cases since 1978 will cost Maryland taxpayers $186 million. That translates into at least $37.2 million for each of the state's five executions since the state reenacted the death penalty. The study estimates that the average cost of Maryland taxpayers for reaching a single death sentence is $3 million, $1.9 million more than the cost of a non-death penalty case. This includes investigation, trial, appeals, and incarceration costs. The study examined 162 capital cases that were prosecuted between 1978 and 1999 and found that those cases will cost $186 million more than those cases would have cost had the death penalty not existed as a punishment.
Can you say that one more time?
Yes. The study examined 162 capital cases that were prosecuted between 1978 and 1999. What they found is that all of those will cost $186 million more than what those cases would have cost had the death penalty not existed.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said. I just needed to make sure. Oh my God.
The amount of money that we're spending on this is crazy. Think of all the things that we could be using that for instead, to actually help people.
Why do my roads suck when this is happening?
At every phase of a case, according to the study, capital murder cases cost more than non-capital murder cases. Of the 162 capital cases, there were 106 cases in which a death sentence was sought, but not handed down. Those cases cost the state an additional $71 million compared to the cost of non-death penalty cases. Those costs were incurred simply to seek the death penalty, where the ultimate outcome was a life or long-term prison sentence. Like, are you fucking kidding me? $71 million that you could have saved had you just tried them for life in prison instead.
They paid $71 million for the chance mm-hmm. To kill him.
It's like a game, like a gamble for them. With our taxpayer money. Thanks.
I hate this country so
our
much.
Our systems are terrible. And since we started this episode in Washington, here are some of their stats. from the final report of the Death Penalty Subcommittee of the Committee of Public Defense. Bro, I'm sorry, all these reports and these committees have incredibly long names and I hate them for it.
They're just hoping that if they make it enough words in the beginning that people will just stop listening.
You might be onto something. This is for the Washington State Bar Association, December 2006. At the trial level, death penalty cases are estimated to generate roughly $470,000 in additional costs to the prosecution and defense over the cost of trying the same case as an aggravated murder without the death penalty, and costs of $47,000 to $70,000 for court personnel. On direct appeal, the cost of appellate defense averages $100,000 more in death penalty cases than in non-death penalty murder cases. Personal restraint petitions filed in death penalty cases on average costs an additional $137,000 in public defense costs. The amount of money being spent on these cases is mind-blowing. To think that in every case, if they are not sentenced to the death penalty, we wasted so much money that could have been saved trying them for life in prison instead. I mean, just like, what the fuck? Why? Why do we want to kill people so badly?
Well, like, universal health care is too expensive and a problem. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars spent to kill people.
And those are just a few states. Think of all of the costs added up. I just wanted people to, like, have a grasp of the situation.
That's insane.
The way that federal funds come through for legal representation is through Legal Services Corporation, which was established in 1974. They operate as an independent 501c3 nonprofit organization that is funded by Congress to promote equal access to justice and provide grants for high-quality civil legal assistance to Americans who earn at or below 125% of the federal poverty level. Let me give you all an example. In 2022, an individual had to make $16,688 or less per year, and $34,688 for a family of four to be eligible for legal aid from LSC. Now, over 60 million families in the U.S. qualify for legal aid from them, which, to be honest, like, so great for those families. But just think about how many of us individuals who make more than 16 grand a year but are absolutely living paycheck to paycheck in fucking poverty. What do you do when the government claims you make too much for legal aid, but you know you are broke as hell because the cost of living and food and everything is so damn high? Like, what? So many of us can't afford legal representation, and you either have to, like, go into debt or fight your own case.
And God forbid you're at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Oh, Jesus. How does this create a level playing field for everyone?
No, it does never. Not. This is insane. Yeah,
absolutely insane. So now let's talk about the lack of ethical standards amongst attorneys and judges in capital cases. A quote from the ACLU. Quote, a recent report on indigent defense by the Texas Defender Service found that judges often appointed defense attorneys not based on their competency or experience, but based on their reputation for rapidly moving cases through the system.
Of course.
The study concluded that death row prisoners, quote, face a 1 in 3 chance of being executed without having the case properly investigated by a competent attorney or without having any claims of innocence or unfairness heard, unquote.
One in three.
Those odds? Ooh.
Me and my siblings.
Yes, exactly.
That's like 3 people in the biggest group chat I've ever been in. That's insane.
Another quote from the ACLU. Clearly, they were one of my biggest sources of information about this topic.
A great source.
Quote, a review of attorney conduct in Tennessee capital cases revealed that in 1/4 of capital cases, Attorneys offered no mitigating evidence during trial. 1/4. No mitigating evidence.
25%.
Like, are you even doing your job? No.
What?
In Philly?
What else are they doing?
What are you doing? What are you doing? In Philadelphia, 60% of all capital cases went without proper investigation or experienced attorneys. Professor James Liebman of Columbia University examined every capital case from 1973 to 1995 and found that 68% of the cases had been reversed. Inadequate representation was one of the primary reasons for the high reversal rate, end quote.
68%. If you got that on a test, that's like a passing grade.
68% reversed because they were like, oh, we fucked up somewhere. How are you doing a good job?
Again, I do not support the death penalty. But if you do, why would you want to have these people in a situation where their representation is so inadequate that later they're going to get off by your thinking, get off because of inadequate representation? They need to have good representation because on the off chance that they're innocent or they are guilty, like, they need to be sorted into the right place and stay there. And if that right place is jail for life, then they'll go there. But if it's they're innocent, then they need to not be killed.
Yes.
In the jail. This for $70 million. This is insane.
And this is like when we get to what standard state by state are these attorneys supposed to be held to?
I'm sorry. There's not just a standard.
Let's get into this. Most states with the death penalty do not have meaningful competency standards. The ABA, the American Bar Association, published its revised guidelines for the appointment and performance of defense counsel in death penalty cases in 2003. It requires that attorney.
So that law can't even drink yet.
It requires that attorneys have, quote, abilities, expertise, and skills in representing clients in capital cases, providing two attorneys, an investigator, and a mitigation specialist in every case, and providing full funding for the defense, end quote. According to the ABA, no state has yet established standards that meet the minimum requirements, which begs the question of why are there no penalties to state courts and attorneys for not working at these standards?
This is the craziest thing I've heard today.
Only today.
Yesterday, we were talking about acid rain. The world's on fucking world's fire on right fire. Now.
How about yours?
Even Goose is like, yeah, absolutely it is. I need to believe that we didn't have standards because we just assumed that we didn't need to. We were just like, yeah, of course everyone is gonna like be good. I cannot.
And it's so funny that it's like the ABA is like, well, we put out standards, they're just not following it. Okay, why are they not getting in trouble? What is happening?
This feels like this is some like Better Business Bureau shit where like it doesn't actually mean anything when you're in trouble with them. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't meet our standards. And it's just like, okay, well, what does that mean? It's like, well, nothing. It just,
you're shit
it just
out of means luck. That
they don't. Just letting you know. Sorry. This sucks. Like, what the fuck? We are talking about people's lives. Yes. Why does this feel like a bunch of rich people getting together and paying a bunch of money to like hunt a human?
Oh god, it almost does feel like that a little bit adjacent, right? So most death penalty states do not have statewide capital defense organizations, and many of the counties that are responsible for the assignment and compensation of these lawyers have extremely small budgets and cannot afford to give competent legal representation in capital cases. From the Innocence Project, quote, a review of convictions overturned by DNA testing reveals a trail of sleeping, drunk, incompetent, and overburdened defense attorneys at the trial level and on appeal. In some of the worst cases, attorneys have slept in the courtroom during trial, been disbarred shortly after finishing a death penalty case, failed to investigate alibis, failed to call or consult experts on forensic issues, and failed to show up to hearings. If the reason for an attorney being incompetent as legally representing someone when their life is on the line is because they are overburdened, sleep deprived, and drunk, probably from being so stressed out, wouldn't we want to change the way our systems work to be sure that people do their jobs properly?
I'm sorry, but if you get disbarred, you're after a death penalty case, that death penalty case needs to
nullify.
It needs to be redone. Nullified. I don't care how much it costs. At that point, you just got disbarred. All of your cases need to be looked at. What the f- You said sleeping, and I was like, whoa, could it get worse than this? And then you followed it up with drunk. That's actually worse, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. As we well know in this country, the cards are stacked against minority communities in our court systems, especially so during capital cases.
I'm so upset about this. This episode is blowing my mind.
From the ACLU, quote, people of color have accounted for a disproportionate 43% of total executions since 1976 and 55% of those currently awaiting execution, end quote. The five jurisdictions with the highest percentages of minorities on their death row are the U.S. military, shocker, with 86%.
Oh my god.
I really wish people could see how animated you have been this episode, Katie. Colorado, with 80%. The U.S. government, again, shocker, with 77%. Louisiana, with 72%. And Pennsylvania, with 70%. That one's for you, Katie.
I hate it here.
Knowing the history of the military government and those three states, it's hard to be surprised by those stats, even though we are fully fucking maddened by them. Wow. In January 2003, researchers at the University of Maryland found that the defendants are much more likely to be sentenced to death if they have killed a white person in a study commissioned by the Maryland governor.
Yeah, I remember some of those stats in our death penalty case episode.
Which... great episode to go back and listen to after you finish this one. One state, Kentucky, tried to do something right. In 1998, they became the first death penalty state to pass the Racial Justice Act, a law that prohibits the death penalty from being sought on the basis of race. After which, the RJA, nope, I hated that. After which, the Racial Justice Act legislation was introduced but was not passed in Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Nebraska, North Carolina, and South Carolina.
Kentucky did that.
Yeah, I know, kind of surprised, right?
Very, not even just kind of, very, very surprised. Wow.
There was a study done by University of Iowa law professor David Baldus and statistician George Woodworth in 1997. Why is that word so hard to say? So hard. Where they examined death penalty rates among all of the death-eligible defendants in Philadelphia between 1983 and 1999. They found that the odds of receiving a death penalty in Philly increased by 38% when the defendant was black.
That's very high.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be higher. Pennsylvania sucks. I'm like upset that I'm like, oh, wow, only 38 for Pennsylvania. But like still, holy shit, 38%.
Yeah, that's crazy. David also conducted another study and found that in the 1980s in Georgia, the death penalty was sought 70% of the time if the defendant was black and the victim was white. But vice versa, it was only 15% white defendant, black victim.
Wow.
70%? To 15%. Like, show me your racial fucking bias. Jesus Christ.
That's... holy shit.
Damn, Georgia. The South is
wild. I can't divide 70 by 15, but I know that it's more than four times.
It's bad. That's bad. And here's a...
fuck Georgia. Sorry. Not sorry. Sorry, not after sorry. That stat.
Here's a fun little tidbit from the ACLU, which will make a fucking light bulb go off in your heads. Quote, prosecutors have unfettered discretion in deciding which cases become capital cases, seeking the death penalty in approximately 1% of all capital eligible cases. Notably, among the 38 states that allow the death penalty, approximately 98% of the prosecutors are white.
This is my shocked voice.
So shocked.
Wow. Who saw that coming? What the fuck? Fucking hate this country. I hate it here.
I also want to read a section from the ACLU in regards to federal death penalty persecutions. Quote, in the fall of 2000, the U.S. Department of Justice released the results of an initial survey of federal death penalty prosecutions. The report shows that the federal death penalty, like its application in the states, is used disproportionately against people of color. Of the 18 prisoners currently on federal death row, 16 are African American, Hispanic, or Asian. From 1995 to 2000, 80% of all the federal capital cases recommended by U.S. attorneys to the Attorney General seeking the death penalty involved people of color. 80%. Even after review by the Attorney General, 72% of the cases were approved for death penalty prosecution that involved minority defendants. 72%.
72. They only dropped 8%. Fuck that.
The DOJ study also revealed the influence that the race of the victim has in determining potential capital cases. U.S. attorneys recommended the death penalty in 36% of the cases with Black defendants and non-Black victims, but only recommended the death penalty in 20% of the cases with Black defendants and Black victims. The Attorney General, John Ashcroft, since taking office, had overturned decisions from local U.S. attorneys to not seek the death penalty 28 times. Of the 28 overrides, 2 involved white suspects, 23 involved suspects who were Black, Latino, or Indigenous, and the 3 other were not able to be determined. Attorneys didn't want to go to the death penalty trial, but the attorney general is like, no, fuck you, let's do it. Let's waste that money.
Wow. Dude, I'm telling you, this is rich people on an island hunting humans.
It's clear that there is systemic racial bias, especially when so many people in positions of power do not represent the majority of the people whose cases they are taking to court for the death penalty.
Yeah. I was going to say, all this makes me think of is every time we see a show or a movie about a horrible leader or government, and when someone does something wrong, they just like take them somewhere and kill them. And the reaction from the public is always like, oh my God. And that's one of the cues that we get as the audience where we're supposed to be like, oh, they're terrible because they do stuff like this. That's exactly what's going on here. You can dress it up with as many trials and judges and try and make it look as fancy as you want it to. Call it the death penalty, like make it sound as official, like as official as you possibly can. But at the end of the day, all you're doing is taking someone out back and murdering them. And sure, in this instance, we make it real fancy. But at the end of the day, we're just paying millions and millions of dollars to murder people. Mm-hmm.
And when the system has been created from the beginning to discriminate against minority communities, it's even harder for those communities to find their ways into positions in these systems. Like I said, the cards are stacked against them, and we have so much work to do to dismantle and rebuild for a truly fair and balanced system. Hopefully one without the death penalty.
Hopefully. And this is one of those things where it falls. God damn it, Goosey. I'm trying to be on my soapbox. And you're just yelling. You're trolling me. Well, I forgot what I was going to say anyway.
You know that I always need to give you ways to get active and make a difference. So, of course, here are some organizations that you can get involved with to help change our justice system. Obviously, the ACLU, the Innocence Project, the Center for American Progress, and Arch City Defenders. I will be adding all of those to our link tree in our socials. And I want to leave you all, listeners, with a question to ponder on. Knowing all that we know now, do we continue to pump more funding into the federal and state court systems to uphold the death penalty at taxpayer expense? Or do we abolish the death penalty and use those funds toward rehabbing and rebuilding our entire justice and prison systems to be more cost-effective, more fair, and for the betterment of our society as a whole? Bye.
Bye. For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.